Okay, perhaps we can start the lectures for the final fifth week of the time series course. It seems that the most interested people are here present, so hopefully all the others will take a look at this recording afterwards. So the theme of this week is about regime changes and time variation in the parameter estimates of the models that we are using to analyze the behavior of the time series. So in a larger term, we are talking about so-called switching models. And in addition to the Brooks book, chapter 10 there, I also would encourage you to take a look at this kind of book. That is, you don't see it very well there, but the title of the book is Nonlinear Time Series Models in Empirical Finance, and it's written by Philips, Hans Francis, and Dick Van Dyke. And this is already a book that is 20 years of age at the moment, but it's still highly relevant because the models have basically not evolved very much after the introduction of the sort of a joint collection of these most relevant models in that book. So those of you that are interested in digging deeper with these models and you would like to apply them in your own research, either in your master's thesis or somewhere else, then I would very much encourage you to also take a look at that book. It should be there in the library, but it's not actually very expensive to even buy. I think it's around 10 or 15 euros, or not more. So it is something that you definitely would perhaps have to take a look at if you are more interested about this. These models are the ones that currently I am perhaps the most interested in, that in addition to the more models in belonging to the Garch family that we discussed last week, because there is actually one very good reason for these models and why they are so interesting at the moment, because the global financial crisis actually introduced a structural break to almost everything in the financial markets. To put it simply, it was such a financial panic that more or less completely changed the correlations between the returns of various segments of financial markets. Correlations between returns from stock markets changed a lot after the global financial crisis, regarding, for example, commodity market returns, like, for example, gold or oil or silver or other precious metal markets, and also between the derivatives markets and stock markets, the correlations changed. So this actually has given me a very good reason or motivation to always consider these kind of structural changes, seasonality, and switching ideas in the modeling of relationships between funds and market variables. So the motivation for all these models is that we have now observed that, for example, global financial crisis induced a really strong structural break in the data generating processes of the time series that we are interested. Obviously, the second big change is now the corona period. It has also changed things a lot. So these are examples of big changes, for example, in market sentiments of the market participants, and changes in the role of, for example, monetary policy actions and government activities in controlling the development of real economy or having an effect on that, and also between the correlations or dependencies between macroeconomic variables and financial market returns. So there are lots of things like this that have an effect on the data generating processes of financial market variables like returns. And when we are using this kind of linear models that we have probably most, we have been most used to use, so they are not basically able to capture these kind of things. And this is why we want to put a special emphasis on how to model, how to parameterize these things into the behavior of the time series. So you just have to understand that you are now focusing ex post on the behavior of the time series, but you are not basically able to say whether it is a variance change or where it is a whether it is a change in the mean, or is it just a if it's just a kind of a outlier observation in your data series. So you would be very interested into revealing whether these kind of structural changes have permanent effects or not. So when we are talking about switches that are kind of a one of single changes, they can be, for example, recording errors simply. So they have no economic meaning at all, but yet they are having an effect on your time series. If you want to model the mean behavior, it might be the case that the shorter is your period, the less you have observations from that variable that you're interested, the more an individual break or change in the time series affects on your parameter estimates, for example, from an AR model. And then another interesting thing is that whether the changes or switches in the observations are occurring frequently. So they are positive and they are negative and they vary kind of randomly. But nevertheless, do they have an effect on the variance of the data that you are considering, or do they have an effect on the mean? So in some cases, we are able to know exactly the timing of the regime change, at least after we have gathered a longer period of observation after that change in the observations. So now we are able to say after around 12 years that the global financial crisis really was a thing that changed many things. But when we had experience from, let's say, couple of years, we were still in the idea that it might be not so long-lasting crisis. But in some economies, it really was. Like, for example, the euro area did not completely recover from the real economic shock that the global financial crisis induced before the corona crisis was hit. We were hit by the corona crisis. So this is actually very relevant. Try to detect what kind of change do you have in the data generating process of your time series. So here is an example of switching behavior. And this is a simple example for one of changes. But for some reason or other, something has happened in the markets or in the behavior of the participants in the markets that has, first of all, changed the variance of this series. So obviously, you are right from just eyeballing, based on the eyeballing of the series, you are clearly able to say that there is some kind of variance change. So obviously, GARCH type models could be relevant here. But the more interesting thing actually here would seem to be the observed behavior and the mean. So it actually seems to be the case that when we have this kind of structural change around the mid of the observations or time series, it actually also has changed the mean. And this is the thing that we are interested in, because basically in when we are using this kind of ARMA models, for example, we are modeling the mean of the time series. So we can generalize the ARMA models to all of the series to be drawn from two or more different generating processes at different times. So we have no reason but to believe that after a structural break has occurred here, variance has changed, yes, but the mean has first changed to some level, but basically after some period of observations, like over 100 observations from the observation number 610 or something like that, the mean might still be once again different compared to the mean from the first over 100 observations after the structural change. So this is a huge thing. We have seen this kind of behavior actually now in the data generating processes, for example, interest yielding assets, and also in exchange rates. In the demonstration number 5, you will be focusing on currency markets. And there you will see that the global financial crisis actually induced a big change there, also for the major currencies. But the main idea here in these lectures is to try to enable to capture the changes in the data generating process that have an effect also, not just only on the variance, but also on the mean. So we have a different ARMA model before observations, before 500th observation, and a different ARMA model after that. So that is the main idea. Up until now, we have assumed that the ARMA model is exactly the same in terms of the structure of the model. So the same number of lags is included. So this is a simple example of AR1 model with the drift term here. So we have the constant term here also. And we are, when we are using simple rolling or recursive regressions, basically we can say that in that case we are able to somehow control for the time variation in these constant terms and also in this coefficient on the AR1 part. But would it be actually useful, more useful, to actually try to determine that whether this change in the phi 1 or phi variable or parameter estimate, actually to be exact, it's not a variable, it's a parameter estimate, whether it is a permanent or not, whether it holds for a certain period of time, so basically the mean is changing here, but for some other period of time the mean is still different. And you can parameterize that in terms of the average behavior for that parameter estimate during a period. So that's the main idea. And actually I want to give you here, this was not in the downloaded version of these this week lectures, but I want to give you here actually one of the best examples of the effects of the global financial crisis that we have observed in the currency markets. So basically in this paper by Du, Depper and Verdölhan, that was published as a leading paper in Journal of Finance in 2018, they are focusing on the so-called covered interest rate parity. In the international finance course, you will be introduced more deeply into the ideas of these parities in currency markets. But nevertheless, that gives an idea whether you have a possibility to make some arbitrage profits based on investing to some markets in terms of the interest yielding assets, because the changes in the currency valuation are not actually meeting up the differences between the interest rates of similar kind of assets in different markets. So you can clearly see here that before the 2007 until 2009 crisis, the covered interest rate parity actually was holding. There were no arbitrage possibilities in the 10 major currency markets in world markets. But after that, basically, there are lots of possibilities. So obviously, this should give you an idea that can I somehow parameterize this change when I'm using, for example, ARMA models to forecasting the future values of the so-called basis, that is the difference between the futures agreements quotation and the spot quotation for a currency. Can I somehow forecast that, because before the 2008 crisis, it was basically not possible, because this is like a more or less a white noise here. So it's basically not possible. The past information doesn't have very much role to do in forecasting the future values. But the situation changed completely. And to me, this was actually the thing that I already spotted from the working paper version of this paper in 2016. And I have been encouraging the people, students, to focus on these kind of things in the financial markets right from that. So I always encourage you to take a data set that also covers the observation before the global financial crisis and after that, because the things have changed after that so much. So for example, here the correlations between the corresponding LIBOR interest rates at 3 months maturity in this case, they have changed. Correlations between the basis, that is the difference between the futures market quotation and the spot quotation of the currency, they have also changed. So this idea, basically, the sort of arbitrage conditions should give you an idea that the basis is around zero when this covered interest rate arbitrage condition or parity holds here. But it's not zero. In many cases, the mean value here is, for example, the New Zealand case, we against the US dollar, we have a positive mean here. But for example, a Danish krona case here, we have clearly negative basis values here. So this is something that immediately should raise in your mind the idea that these things have to be modeled based on some kind of regime switching or switching model in general terms. So my main message to you is that when you are analyzing data after the global financial crisis, you cannot basically assume that your parameter estimates from any kind of your model would be constant in your sample, because the things change here quite a lot. And this is one of the reasons where, for example, in Garch modeling, I always would like to take a look at this kind of a dynamic conditional correlation versions of the Garch family, because the correlations between the individual asset markets have changed. Return correlations have changed. So that is one of the key motivations for me to take a really deep look at these models. How can we capture these things in a parametric representation? So once again, draw the series. That is the starting point when you want to detect whether you have switches in your data generating processes of your time series. So it may be obvious from a plot or from knowledge of the history of the series that you should actually have time variation in the dependencies between the variables. And you can determine that using a model. It can be there in fixed intervals, or it can be there as a seasonality. For example, in a stock market data, it's very common to try to detect seasonalities. Do you have weekday effects? Do you have month effects? What kind of effects you have in your return series? So there are a number of different approaches available, and the from the course books, the book by Francis and Van Dyke, chapter 3 focuses on these, and then the Brooks book in chapter 10 is focusing also on these things. So first of all, in all these kind of models, you should go back first to take a look at your data frequency, because that should give you an eye whether you have reasons to believe that there might be some kind of reoccurring behavior for certain points of time in your observations. So if you have quarterly data, it's obvious that every fourth quarter perhaps could behave in a similar way compared to all the other quarters, or if you have monthly data, then every 12th month you might have similar behavior. So months in 12 months interval could be behaving similarly and a bit differently compared to the other months. So Decembers in a monthly data, all Decembers might be different compared to all the other months. In daily data, for example, Fridays can be different compared to the Tuesdays. So you want to somehow be able to control for this, because it's something that's basically your pricing model would not be able to explain. It's kind of an anomaly that you want to capture in your data generating process, because it induces a pattern to your time series. So seasonal effects in financial markets have been very often observed, and they are termed as calendar anomalies in many cases. These examples are the day of the week effects and open and close price quotations effects and January effects and the holiday or seasons effects. So in these cases, you might end up having a situation where there is some kind of statistically different behavior compared to all the other observations. So you should be actually right from the start somehow try to capture that behavior as a specific pattern that is being observed in your data. So after you have controlled for these, then it might actually be the case that, for example, these efficient market hypothesis assumptions are holding. So basically, you are not able to use prior information or the historical information to forecast the returns in the future. So the efficient market hypothesis in this FAMA type framework is holding after you have controlled for these seasonalities in your data. So, like I have emphasized right from the beginning, the first thing always is to take a look at your data, draw the figures, and stop figuring what is your frequency, what is the data frequency, and take a closer look at those observations. So how do we control for seasonality? This is actually the simplest possible way to detect any kind of regime type behavior or switching behavior in the data generating processes. Use the dummy variables. We will be using, or you will be using, those in the demonstration number 5, because you have some interesting things there happening in the currency market data for the three main currencies against the US dollar in the most recent observations. So one way to cope this is to include dummy variables. Dummy always is a dichotomic variable. So it means that for the interesting phenomenon, the interesting thing, you are imposing the value of 1 for all those observations. So for example, if you want to control for the Friday observations in your daily data set, then set always the dummy variable to get value 1 for each Friday and 0 for all the other observations. And analogously to all the other, if you want to control for Wednesday observations, that they might have some, for some reason or other, they might have a different role, then set up the dummy to get the value of 1 for all Wednesday observations and 0 for all the other observations. Now, when you use this dummy variable approach, you can basically control any kind of things. For example, the simplest way to control for the effect of global financial crisis in that CIP experiment, Dudepper and Vertehan paper, would have been that if you are regressing, for example, the difference in the interest rates against the basis for the Danish krona, then obviously, if we go back here and take a look at this, you are focusing on the behavior of the Danish krona here. So it seems that the basis points, or the difference between, or the basis value is negative after the global financial crisis. So basically, to test for this, you could actually introduce into a regression. I have not done this, and the guys didn't do this in the paper, but this comes straight to my mind. You do a regression for the holding of this hypothesis. So you are explaining basically the difference between the dollar-dominated interest rate at 3-month maturity against the LIBOR of Danish krona at 3-month maturity. And in the regression model, if the CIP holds, basically, it should be equal to the 1 over the horizon, which is 3 here, times the difference between the forward agreement notation and the spot for the Danish krona against US dollar. You can build up a regression for this. It seems that the covered interest parity, so the basis relationship, is not holding after the global financial crisis. So around already at the beginning of 2008 or late 2007, you could impose a dummy variable to this regression. And it seems to be the case that the dummy should have, or the basis should have, gone to the negative side more. So basically, if you estimate a model where you include the dummy that has values of 1 from, let's say, end of 2000, let's say somewhere, you would have to take a look at the data actually, but June 2007 or something like that, and include that dummy variable so that the dummy has values of 1 for all these rest of the observations and 0 before that. Then you are controlling for the effect of the global financial crisis on the CIP relationship for the Danish krona against the US dollar. And a priori, just based on taking a look at your data, it should have a negative parameter estimate. So it induces a change in the constant of the regression model regarding the difference between the interest rates. So you can build up basically any kind of dummy variable setting. You just have to somehow give economic reasoning why do you want to control for that kind of behavior in the data generating processes of the variables. Okay, and you should always, in case of controlling for the effects on the slope, the constant term in your regression model. Obviously, constant term, for example, in that CIP regression is relevant after global financial crisis, but it was not relevant before that. So basically, for some currencies, the constant term should be negatively estimated, and for some currencies, it should be positively estimated. The global financial crisis has induced a more or less permanent effect to some currencies, and it's different between the currencies. So basically, to control for that, you should actually perhaps include also a dummy variable, but the dummy variable in that case would be perhaps in more in connection to the role of the basis, the difference between the forward quotation and the spot market quotation. Not so much for controlling the level of the constant term. So try to avoid so-called dummy variable trap, which means that don't set every observation to get value of 1 if you are controlling for the changes in the constant term of your regression model. So we always need 1 less than the seasonality of the data. So basically, for example, when you go in your monthly data, if you want to control for the effects on the constant term using a dummy variable for each and every month, then leave 1 of the months without the dummy. So construct only 11 dummies if you want to include the constant term separately to your model. But if you want to skip the constant term and give a specific emphasis so that the constant term is varying between the months, then skip the constant term and put the dummy variable to each and every month separately. So here's the case for quarterly data. So in this case, if you want to highlight the role of the first quarter, that is different compared to the role of the second quarter, and it's still different from the role of the third quarter, and fourth quarter is still different, then include a a dummy variable for each and every quarter. So set it to be 1 for D1, so the first quarter, and 1 for D2, the second quarters, and so on. But in this case, skip the constant term completely from the regression model. So in that way, you are able to avoid the problem of multicollinearity. So use just three dummy variables if you want to include the general constant term to your model. So that is a bit difficult thing to do. So you should somehow give a priori reasoning for the choice of the quarter, for example, in the quarterly data that you want to skip or leave out of the dummy construction. What is the reason for skipping exactly the first quarter and including the constant term in general to the model? So this is the so-called dummy variable trap. So it works by changing the intercept. So here we are now focusing on the case where we don't have, for a quarterly data, we don't have the dummy variable trap. So we are including the fourth quarter, constant term, general constant term here. So basically that general constant term here now captures the role of the fourth quarter effects in itself. And the B1 plus this beta 1 plus this gamma 1 is now together capturing the effects of the constant term in the first quarter. So you are highlighting for some reason or other the first, second, and third quarters here. And then you have a set of other variables as explanatory variables here. So basically, in this kind of regression, what is the sign of the parameter estimate on the x variable here? Is it positive or negative?
Positive.
Yeah. Why is it positive? Do you have a positive relationship here?
It's an inverse relationship rather.
Yeah, it's a negative relationship. So basically, in terms of the correlations between the x2 variable here and y, you have a negative relationship, or the x variable here. We don't need this 2 here actually, but nevertheless, the main thing here is that you are not controlling this effect of x variable in various quarters. So you assume that the effect of X is the same in all quarters. It doesn't differ between the quarters, but the constant term is different. So you are simply controlling for the role of constant term. It's different here in the period one, and it's different in the period quarter one, and in the different in the quarter two, and different in the quarter three. So basically, you have to be careful here what you are controlling for. For some reason or other, you want to assume that the quarter four observations have only this kind of effect, and the quarter two observations are a bit bigger. If you have a positive parameter estimate, you can obviously get also negative parameter estimates, so it will be changing these positionings of these regression lines. But you are assuming here that the parameter estimate beta 2 on the x is negative because you have a negative linear relationship between y and x. So as an example for controlling these seasonal effects, we have a very nice paper by Brooks and Persant there as an example that is related to using the stock market data. So they are examining the day of the week effect. So they want to focus especially on these South Asian developing markets for South Korea, Malaysia, Philippines, Taiwan, and Thailand. Data are on a daily close-to-close basis for all weekdays. So for example, when you use daily data, be careful when you are measuring the actual price observation. Is it the closing price, or is it the opening price, or is it the mid price average price for the whole day, but that has to be the same for each and every day. So they are controlling for 5-day trading week. So Mondays to Fridays are the trading days, and they are analyzing the period of from the beginning of basically the end of 1989 to the 19th of January 1996. Basically, this is an interesting period because they are actually skipping the critical or the crisis period in these developing markets. So basically, if you want to analyze or dig deeper in the in terms of the East Asian crisis period, you should have basically extend the model. But it might be the case that you have to control for many other things there because the markets collapsed in all these cases actually into the 1998 already. But they are now focusing on a stable period of these stock markets. So they use daily dummies to, they want to focus specifically on given days within a week. So that is the reason why they want to have these dummy variables for each and every week. So they are not including the constant term into their regression model at all. So in this case, when you are excluding the constant term, the individual coefficient on the dummy variables, they can be interpreted as the average return on each day of the week. So basically, you are assuming here that the returns are not for each and other days, they are staying the same, but this is the average return for the first day, second Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. So they get the results from here. What kind of day effects or day of the week effects are you able to see here? So they are reporting the parameter estimates on these dummies, and then they report the T ratios in parentheses. They also give the marginal significance levels at 5 and 1% levels. So in which markets you have some kind of day of the week effects and what kind of effects you have. Yeah, Teemu.
Malaysia seems to have a positive effect on Monday, and Taiwan seems to have positive effect on Monday, negative on Tuesday, and positive on Thursday, and South Korea has negative on Wednesday.
Yeah, exactly. And it's now about the average returns. So it's actually interesting in based of or on view of the how to build up a some kind of trading model. It would be suggesting that it's not profitable to trade very much actually on Tuesdays because you the average return on Tuesday trading is actually negative. But for example, on Monday you can have some kind of marginal benefit from investing on Mondays, especially because you have a positive return, average return there, and also on Thursday. But basically, pretty much nothing relevant in all the other cases. Nothing in the Philippines, so you don't have any kind of seasonalities and in or day of the week effects in Philippines and not in Thailand at all. In South Korea, also only on Wednesdays, and it's a loss. So it's a negative average return on Wednesday based on a trading rule that it would be based on only trading in, on Wednesdays. So this is an example of controlling for the effects of constant term or the slope of the constant term there. So it always is dependent on your research questions. What are you interested about? In this case, you are interested about whether you have you are able to build up some kind of trading rule or trading strategy based on week day in these markets. It doesn't seem to be very beneficial actually. So in the next case, it perhaps should be something that you are not only interested about the average returns, so you are basically interested about the effects of some other information on the returns on some given dates. So in that case, you are talking about this. So this is basically really a more like a non-linear model. So you are interested about the slope dummies, not just intercept dummies or the dummies controlling for the level of the constant term. So you can use this kind of non-linear representation also. So once again, you just have to decide what are you interested about controlling. Why would in certain periods of observations the x variable have a different effect on the y variable than it has in all the other observations? Or why would, for example, the weekly returns or weekly observations of an explanatory variable that you have, for example, for the returns, why would they be different compared? A Friday observation would be different from all the other observations in all the other weekdays. So, for example, here we have a case for biannual, twice yearly, or open and closed data. So in the latter case, we would be defining for all the open observations the dummy to be one, and for close price observations the dummy to be zero. So it's once again the original thing that you are interested about. It's a more or less dichotomous thing. It's either on or it's off. Whether its effect is relevant in terms of the x variable having an explanatory power on the y variable, that's the thing that you are interested about. So you always have to first decide the phenomenon that you are capturing with the dummy variable. But these kind of dummies basically change the slope but leave the intercept unchanged. So the intercept part here in this regression model, it's this alpha here. So it's the horizontal vertical distance between the x-axis and the point where we are cutting this y-axis. So it's the alpha. But in when we control for the additional information captured by the dummy, we are controlling for the slope effect. So here we are basically assuming. What are we assuming in this case for the parameter estimate on this non-linear part here? Is it positive or is it negative? So what are we assuming about this gamma parameter estimate compared to this? First of all, what is the assumption about the sign of the beta parameter estimate here on x? Is it positive or negative?
Positive.
Yeah, so what we are assuming about this non-linear effect of certain observations of xt to have a different effect on y compared to all the other xt observations.
It has a positive effect as
So
well.
it increases in a non-linear way the effect of x. So it's a some kind of thing that has a role to play in also the explanatory power effects. So the joint effect is the sum of beta and this gamma. The joint effect is the sum of beta and gamma because we are controlling something in relation to x values or x values by using this dummy variable. And in our idea, it has a positive effect on the slope of the x variable here. So this is something that you basically, based on a priori ideas or your theoretical derivations, actually built up into a model and then start to testing for the statistical significance of this thing. So, for example, in the Southeast Asian stock returns data case from Brooks and Pearson paper in International Journal of Forecasting, I think it was, it's allowed for the possibility that the different returns on different days of the week could be a result of different levels of risk on different days. So they are basically now introducing to the model also the variance component or the riskiness of these stock markets. So they parameterize this by re-estimating the model, allowing for different betas on different days of the week using slope dummies. So basically the slope dummies are constructed like this, that DIT is the ith dummy variable taking the value of 1 for T equals Y and 0 otherwise. And RWM is the return on the world market index. So basically they are doing a capital asset pricing model kind of a regression here, because basically the beta parameter on this variable here is the capital asset pricing model beta. When you are explaining an individual stock return with the world or the global or the market portfolio index return, then basically you are doing a capital asset pricing model type of regression. That's the simplest representation of capital asset pricing model. So both the risk and return are allowed to vary across the days of the week. The thing that they are interested about is whether the CAPM beta for the world market index is different in different days of the week. And this is actually that is relevant to do also in the more modern data. And it's interesting to find out whether there are differences between the markets. So the I here refers to the weekday, and T once again refers to the observation, number of observation. So they do this for these Thailand, Malaysian, and Taiwanese markets. And what can you say about this thing now? The beta here refers to the capital asset pricing model type beta, where the market model or the market portfolio is the world market index. So what can you say about the weekday effects first here? Where do we have a weekday effect for the constant term, and in which markets we have kind of a statistically significant beta parameter estimate? Where we have weekday effects for the constant or the average returns, in which markets and in what days of the week? Well, in Thailand and Malaysian markets, we have a positive average return on Mondays, and it's statistically significant at 1% risk level even. Also on Thursday in Malaysian markets, we have a positive, but only 10% significance level. But what about the risk-adjusted or riskiness of the markets compared to the world market portfolio? Which of the markets and on which days they would seem to be more risky compared to the global portfolio, world portfolio, or which days and which markets would seem to be less risky compared to the global portfolio? Remind yourselves of the capital asset pricing model. When you have a parameter estimate for the beta, then if it's exactly one, then your considered market is exactly as risky as the market portfolio, okay? Because it moves into one, in a one-to-one relationship towards the market portfolio. So for example, on Tuesdays, the Thailand market is actually exactly as risky as the world market, because this is very close to one. It's statistically significant and very close to one. But what about all the other days? What can you say about the Thailand market? Is it more risky or is it less risky than the global portfolio?
Is it less risky?
Yeah, it's less risky because the beta coefficient is clearly below one. You can test actually the null hypothesis whether the beta is exactly to one or not by constructing the day statistics by calculating the difference between, for example, for the beta value on Wednesdays for the Thailand market, where it seems to be statistically significant at 5%, 1% risk level, then calculate 0.60 minus 1, because your hypothesized value for the exactly same riskiness as the world market is to be beta to be 1. So 0.06 minus 1 divided by the standard error of this parameter estimate here. And you can actually calculate the standard error because the t statistics has been given here. T statistics is parameter estimate divided by the standard error. So standard error is obviously the parameter estimate divided by the t statistics. So basically, you can then calculate also the standard error. Multiplied by the t statistics. The parameter estimate multiplied by the t statistics. So you can then calculate also the for the null hypothesis that it is exactly as risky as the world market. But in all the cases where we are able to detect some kind of seasonality for Thailand market, it seems to be still that the Thailand market is less risky than the world market. And this actually holds also for all the other cases where we are able to find statistically significant correlations or relationships between the world market. But this gives you an idea that actually the first thing that is relevant to be controlled for in all these markets and basically almost in all weekdays is actually the return from the world portfolio. So these are in relation statistically dependent on the riskiness of the world portfolio clearly. But the riskiness might be not at the same level as it is in the world portfolio. So this is once again a very simple example of how to use capital asset pricing model for these kind of analysis. Interesting results. We have some kind of evidence for day of the week effects, but more evidence about the dependence of the individual markets in each and every weekday on the riskiness or the returns in the world market portfolio. Okay, so this is the simplest case for controlling. So you can basically just now here, or you should here just decide the phenomenon that you are interested about, and then start building up a dummy representation or dummy variable to control for that effect. And in the demonstration, you will be doing this for the currency markets. You will be taking a look at the data, what kind of spikes you have there in the data, and what kind of effects do those spikes have on the data generating process of your currency market observations. So we will start now discussion about this, let's say, more heavy duty parametric representations of these non-linearities in view of the regime-dependent observations. So the family of regime-dependent models that we are focusing here, there are lots and lots of other possibilities also, but these are the most frequently used models for the parameterization of the regime change. TAR refers to the threshold autoregressive models. CETAR refers to the self-exciting threshold autoregressive models. STAR refers to the smooth transition autoregressive models, and Markov switching refers to Markov switching, basically. But already from these short acronyms for the various models, you see that there's always this AR thing. So the past history of the observations of either the thing or the variable that we are interested in, it is containing some kind of switching behavior that is relevant, or from some other variable that is somehow related to the variable that we are interested about. So basically, the theoretical models behind your analysis should give you an idea whether the conditioning, regime dependence conditioning variable or information comes from the series that you are focusing, or whether it comes from some other completely different variable. So if you are using this family of models, of regime dependent models, you are able to capture also the information, the role of information from other variables to the variable that you are interested about. So we have assumed here that we usually know the change in the behavior, when it takes place and how it takes place, what kind of effect does it have to the mean or to the variance of the series. So this is, for example, the case when we have clearly something exogenously defined in the market or in the economy that we are focusing on. So there might be a change in regulation, completely exogenous shock that is not a priori forecastable. You cannot forecast that kind of shock. You cannot forecast terrorist attack. You cannot forecast a war, basically. Well, a war is something that basically you could be able to even forecast. But for example, an earthquake is not forecastable a priori. Hurricane is usually not. Nowadays, we have actually quite good forecasting models also for hurricanes. But basically, it's kind of these shock type, huge shock type things. So it's not always in these cases, it's not always sure that we know the exact timing when the shock comes. And what kind of change does it introduce to the data generating process of your observations? So there's obviously, for example, in the case of wars, there's a long period of uncertainty, global uncertainty, and there are some kind of indicators nowadays actually that can forecast the start of a war, for example. Let's not focus those on too much, but there are some kind of newspaper-based information or indicators that you can use, actually. And usually in markets, it can be the case, actually. Actually, we have seen that in, for example, in this CIP case, that covered interest parity case, already before the complete collapse of the markets in Lehman Brothers bankruptcy in September 2008, there was at least 1 year period before that when the market started to forecast actually that things are going bad. Information flow from the subprime markets of the US housing market were actually important in that way, that they actually gave indications that things might be going bad. So basically, you should be able to somehow model also this development in your time series, or capture somehow the effect of these kind of things. So typical feature of several financial macroeconomic time series is the regime dependence. There are two or more different regimes and behavior at the time. Series is very much regime dependent. So regime dependence means that, for example, in an ARMA representation of the data, already the relevant lag structure under regime one, let's say before global financial crisis, for the interest differences or the basis in the currency markets, our AR model for that period before Lehman Brothers collapse, for example, or bankruptcy, is different compared to the AR, best possible AR representation after that. Even the lag structures can be different. So if we are estimating or forcing the data to be behaving like an ARMA 1-1, for example, for both periods, it might be a priori ridiculous thing to do. There's no reason to believe that after the global financial crisis, exactly the same kind of information from the past would be relevant to forecast the future values as it was before the crisis. So these models now enable this thing to be taken into account. And this is the thing why I am so big fan of these models at the moment. And so basically, one of very good examples of a regime-dependent behavior of financial market variables is this S&P 500 composite index. So obviously, this is for the price levels. So if you were to analyze this using time series models, then obviously, first of all, the thing that you should observe here clearly, and you are able to actually detect using unit truth tests, is that this is not stationary. Prices are not stationary. And basically all the models that we are focusing here now, also in regime switching family, they should be used for stationary data series. So the first thing to do for these kind of data would be to focus on returns. So take log returns, log differences of the prices, multiply those by 100 if you want to use the percentage representation, and they should actually be stationary. But the first step to reveal also the possibility for the regime changes is actually based on taking a look at the price levels. Because here it's clearly increasing all the time. Here it's decreasing for a period of time, then increasing once again, but perhaps with a different time trend slope, and once again going down here, and once again starting to rise. So clearly different regimes, at least for the part of the behavior of the prices. And this might actually be also reflected in the behavior of the returns. And the returns are the ones that you should be actually focusing. You can actually say that when you are focusing these returns on these returns, the mean of the returns is almost surely it's zero. So it's a mean reverting data series, but the mean in subsamples actually might be something that is different from zero because the variance changes quite a lot. So basically using this unit, not unit truth series, which is a stationary series of returns, you should actually be somehow able to capture also the various regimes. For example, here during 2003, end of 2003, until the beginning of the crisis here, you can see that the returns are fairly stable. So the volatility is very low here. It's not a huge one. So if you take a look at the prices are increasing more or less in a steady way. But here, when the sudden collapse happens here, it's obviously something that you should have to control somehow parametrically in this price process and also clearly in the returns process, because there's a huge change in the variance, and the variance change might actually introduce also a change in the mean. The mass is here, so the mean for the returns is obviously, it's going to be probably negative here for a period of time. And you would be interested about whether you can extract some kind of crisis periods from your data and the booming and busting periods differently. So booming periods are the good developments of return, and the busting or crisis periods are the negative developments of the returns. You cannot do that basically for the non-stationary prices. Even though the interesting things here really are detected in terms of eyeballing in the prices, but these are stationary. Returns are stationary. So you should be actually using the returns in all your analysis for your further discussions or further scrutinies of this area. Is there a regime dependence here? That's the main question now. Clustering, volatility clustering is clear. So you could try some kind of Karch model. You might be able to find that the Karch 1-1 model, Karch in mean or even exponential Karch, or some kind of nonlinear or asymmetric Karch representation is a good model for your data. But then you would probably some kind of a fitting once again the same model to all the data, and you would be skipping out, for example, the special focus on crashes or the collapse periods in the markets. If you want to especially focus on those, you have to make some kind of decision in terms of the returns when you have a crash period. Control for that separately. So here, for example, we are controlling for the crash periods by once again using a dummy representation. So we are constructing a new variable based on the behavior of the returns. So when the daily returns are dropping at least 19%, then we are saving the value of the dummy variable for crash to be one for each and every observation when the daily price is decreasing at least 19%. This is fairly standard definition for a crash in the stock markets. You cannot basically use this for other markets, but in the literature, the crash has been previously mostly defined in terms of observing over almost 20% collapses in the, at the daily level. So the crash period starts from the previous top and ends when the bottom level is reached. Otherwise, you set the dummy variable once again to be zero. So you are imposing now, you are constructing the new variable, and you want to analyze whether that crashing period has a specific effect on the data generating process of the returns. So here the regime is not endogenously determined, because only after we have the observations, we are able to construct this crash dummy variable. So it's not endogenously determined. So we have defined that based on this rule, that when there is a collapse in the prices that is at least 19%, then denote that to be a crash in your data. And we have not tested here also for the correct lag length. So we are just imposing an idea whether the crash period has a role to do there. So this is very rough and ad hoc approximation, giving some indication of possible regime switching behavior in the data generating process. So this model is estimated by linear regression, so just standard OLS regression with these heteroscedasticity and autocorrelation robust standard errors. So when we do for these data, we do this kind of regression, we are able to find out that actually there is kind of a role for the crash, because the mean during the normal market conditions is this alpha one here. So remind yourselves from the general representation, the linear regression model. So we have 5 lakhs of returns here. We have not used any kind of, this is very rough dealing with the data, because we have not used, for example, any kind of information criteria, decision rules to try to detect the optimal lag structure. We are using daily data, so perhaps 5 lakhs might be relevant here, but we want to control whether the crash periods have specific effects on the returns, mean returns. And we will find out that they actually do. So during the normal market conditions, the mean return is given by this. And during the market crash, it's the difference between the mean and the coefficient on the alpha 2 or crash dummy variable, alpha 2 coefficient on the crash dummy variable. So it has a decreasing effect on the mean of the return, and it's something that it should be the case. But this is very rough example of how to parameterize something that is of interest to you in your data. So it seems to be the case that also the autoregressive terms and the lag structures seem to be regime dependent, because these betas change when you control for the crash periods. Beta 1.1, beta 1.3 are different in the case, for example, when you control for the lag for the crash periods. R squared here is very low still. So even though you control for the crash periods, you don't have a very good explanatory power in your data generating or in your regression model for the returns. But we have clearly, we have a regime dependence, because crash periods have clearly a different effect on the average returns in this S&P 500 series. So even though this model gave some indication of regime dependence, it has a big problem induced, because we have exogenously defined the regime. So we have only defined or had an idea that crash periods are clearly something that have an effect. So we have control for the crash periods. And they are very much, the results are very much dependent on this a priori decision that we have made. So you should be absolutely sure in terms of your building up of your model that it is thing that you really definitely want to have a look at. So basically, you might be accused of kind of a data snooping here, but it's not data snooping if it's economically relevant thing to be analyzed. And it might be the case that our results are just a by chance, we got these results, and the choice of these regimes or the control variable, that dummy variable, was more or less arbitrary. So in what follows, we will discuss in much more details about the possibilities of using time series analytical models to reveal endogenously the regime. We don't have any idea a priori what are the things that we should be controlling for. So only afterwards that we have done the estimation using these regime switching approaches, we are able to somehow perhaps find a connection to something else that happens in the markets. So we are not a priori sort of a focusing on only certain observations or giving them a specific emphasis in our results. Only after that we have fitted some kind of parameter representation for the regime dependence in the observed series that we are interested about, we will be starting a discussion about the relevance of these things. How can we explain that we have these kind of observations or these kind of results? Okay, so we will be discussing about these threshold models, self-exciting threshold models, so SETAR models, smooth transition models, STR models, and Markov switching models in these. And these are all a bit different in terms of the parameterization of the regime effects or regime change effects. So let's have now a 10 minutes break here. So my time is now 13:28. So let's be back here 20 to 2. So let's have a 10 minutes coffee break. Okay, so I think we can continue now, since I'm recording again. So the first case that we are dealing here with is the so-called self-exciting threshold autoregressive model, SETAR model. And it has been originally introduced by Tong already in 1978. So these are fairly old models. Actually, these appeared quite at the same time as the Box, Jenkins, or the ARMA modeling approach in general. So basically, these were developed in tandem with the ARMA models, actually. And the main idea here in the threshold autoregression model is that we have, let's say that we have, for example, an interest rate data series. We have a three-month Euribor interest rate that we are focusing. For some reason or other, we have some idea that perhaps there is some kind of a structural change in the data generating process that would have to be controlled somehow. So basically, the same kind of AR model would not hold, for example, for the positive values of Euribor rates, as does hold for the negative values. So we have now observed that also the negative values for nominal interest rate in the euro area are possible. So Euribor 3 months has been negative from April of 2015, and it still is. So basically, it might be relevant to assume that in the data generating process of Euribor, the AR process at the positive side of the observations is not the same as it is in the negative side. And it actually, it is not the same. I have estimated an AR model for those. And in the
Excuse me. I think we lost your sound. I don't think anyone can hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, good. So where did you lose me? What was the last thing that you remember? I think I was discussing the Euribor interest rate at 3 months maturity.
Yes, yeah.
And the relevant threshold rate or relevant threshold value might be the zero value for that, because we have now observed the negative observations also for that. So in the case of SETAR, self-exciting threshold autoregressive models, the threshold variable Q is the actual series that we are focusing on. So the threshold variable is the Euribor 3 months. But we are assuming that the lagged history of that might be affecting in a different way in the positive regime or positive era of observations compared to the negative era's observations. So here is the positive era. So Euribor interest rate is at the positive side, and the negative side is here in the first equation. The main thing here is that we are now allowing that, first of all, constant terms are different in the AR model in the positive regime compared to the negative regime, and also the AR parameter estimate is different. And actually, there's no reason to assume that the AR1 representation, so only the first lags of the Euribor 3 months, would be the only relevant information in the negative area, even though they are the only relevant information in the positive area. So basically, in the negative era, we might actually have an AR2 model. But nevertheless, the interesting thing is whether the actual share is at the positive or negative era. I think this gives a very nice example of the relevance, because clearly in economic terms, the era of negative interest rates is really, really interesting, because it's sort of we didn't have in the textbook presentations of finance and banking, let's say about 5 years ago at all. And now it's something that has to be considered as a new norm we indeed are having negative observations for negative values for the nominal interest rates. So the main thing here is that is it actually, we try to find an answer to the question that is it relevant to have this kind of threshold? And you can do this for every kind of variable, but remember to always somehow give an economic reasoning for the threshold. What is the relevant threshold value and why is it relevant? I think, for example, in the Euribor data, Euribor interest rate data, it's clearly relevant to consider the negative interest rate period different from positive interest rate period. It's a threshold. Zero is a threshold. Okay, so basically we are focusing on the possibility that when we have negative observations for the Euribor 3 months, the model for that data generating process in AR1 form is different from the model, even though it might be AR1 still for the both regimes, but the parameters are different. So the main idea once again is that if it is relevant to extract this threshold value for the actual series, then the residuals from these models should be behaving in a nice way. So they are identically and identically and independently distributed. So the expected value is zero and the variance is constant. And there is no correlation between the contemporaneous values after we have controlled for the AR1 term. So the lag length in this, for the part of this threshold variable, relevant lag length for the threshold variable, it's determined endogenously by statistical inference. That's the main thing here that we actually also assume. These assumptions regarding homoscedasticity of residuals and normal distribution can actually be relaxed. So it doesn't necessarily have to be if we have a case, for example, for Garch representation. So we can have a Setar-Garch model. So the heteroscedasticity of these guys' error terms here is captured by the Garch process. And for example, we can have a fat-tailed d-distribution also for these error terms, but nevertheless, we can still estimate the Setar parameter estimates here. So basically, this model generalizes to any ARP lag structure, and it also allows the possibility that in another regime, so let's say, for example, in a negative interest rate regime, we have different set of lags here compared to the positive values for Euribor interest rates, for example. So it can be written also in this way. So the general representation for this AR model is basically now, once again, you can give it in this kind of a dummy variable representation, basically, when you notice that the relevant thing here in terms of determining the values of dummy is the value of the past observations in the actual series that you are modeling here. So the parameter estimate or the deterministic part of the model times one minus the regime dummy that is dependent on the value of the threshold value. So basically you should how now here be able to determine what is the relevant threshold. But basically you could do, for example, in a Euribor interest rate data, for example, you can decide that C equals zero is the relevant thing here. The relevant thing is the division of the observations between negative and positive. So you just impose now that in the positive era, it's a bit different thing, and in the negative era, it's a bit different thing, and in the positive era, it's a bit different thing. So this is one minus the observations for the regime dummy to be value of one, and then this is the rest of the observations. So basically, this is just. But I personally prefer always the representation in this form. I usually don't use this, but this is basically the same information. So regarding all regime-dependent models, the conventional terminology is the following. This comes from the literature of Timo Teräsvirta and Anderson, that are actually one of the, let's say, leading researchers in these threshold models. So if you want to take a good look of the literature, how it has evolved since 1980s, then just take a look at Timo Teräsvirta's writings. He's the one of the leading guys in these models, and he has been publishing papers on these already from 1980s. So go to Scopus and write the search term for author to be Teräsvirta Timo, and you will find huge number of papers on this, on these things. So Timo's definition for these models is that he wants the skeleton of the model to be the deterministic part. So this is the representation for the deterministic part, and it's said to be in equilibrium if the function here is holding with the threshold value. So basically that Y star can be defined to be a kind of an attractor for the mean value if the observations are at the mean value, and it goes to the same attractor value also in the future with high probability as the information or the number of observations or the future periods is approaching indefinite. So basically this is the statistical, let's say that statistical definition for the model. So he wants to use this kind of representation, but I fully understand that from an applied econometrician's point of view, this is a bit, perhaps a bit not so clear representation of the model to be understood, but this is the one that I prefer to use in the case of SETAR models. The main thing here is to understand that the conditioning or the threshold information is the past history from some lag length in the history of the observations of the focused variable that you are interested about. So here are some examples of SETAR models. So here are examples for the constant observations or the constant parameters in various representations. So here's the phi 1 1. So if we go back here to the representation, so here is once again the phi 1. So it's the lagged effect of the considered variable in the first regime when we are assuming that, for example, Euribor is negative or equal to zero. And here is the coefficient, same coefficient on the lagged effect when Euribor is positive. So take a look at this. This refers to the constant term. So basically the parameter estimates, we are allowing that in the different regimes, the effect is of similar magnitude, but with different coefficients. So this is just to give an example. And this is a simulation experiment. So we are generating a number of observations for the returns, 200 observations for the returns, and setting the original or starting value to be zero. And let's assume that the for the error terms, they are normally distributed with the mean value of zero, and the variance or the standard deviation is 0.25. So the variance is 0.25 to the power 2. So what does this generate in terms of the data series? So you see that basically it might be actually interesting to reveal that there is also the possibility for different constant terms in different regimes. So here we have the same constant term. It's zero in both cases. And here we have minus 0.03 and plus 0.1 here in the different regimes. So it generates clearly different series. So basically here it might be actually very relevant to try to extract. So this is after we have given the parameterization to the model, use it a random number generator, and then generated the theories that might be behaving in like this setter type behavior. So here we have some differences between the regimes. Here basically it's not possible to detect differences in the regimes. So the mean in other regime might be different compared to the other regime, and also here in these cases. So if you take a look at your data and you find this kind of behavior, like here in these three last cases, then it might be actually relevant for you to try to use perhaps setter or other smooth transition representations for the data. So for almost every kind of financial market data, or from the last, let's say 12 or 13 years, this actually might be relevant. So in terms of regime change detection, or the idea that you might have regime changes in the data generating process, take a look at these models, because in the most recent observations for international financial markets, you might have this. So as an example of a setter model, we have one example from that course book that I showed you at the beginning of the lecture. So we have here a case of a setter model based on that idea. So this is actually that simulated case where we have what we discussed here in the figures. So this is exactly that case. And with the following parameter values, so we have all here phi 11 to minus 0.5, and phi 12 is 0.5. Constant terms here, or the threshold value is one, the zero here. So basically this could be resembling the behavior of, for example, the Euribor interest rates in the most recent data, but this is not fitted to the actual data. But this kind of behavior you could actually try to detect now from the most recent behavior of Euribor. Just remember to have one of the key things here is that remember to have enough observations from the period of positive observations for the interest rates and from the period of negative observations. Optimally, you should have probably an equal amount of observations for those both. Okay. So here we are imposing the various possibilities, and the time series are plotted there. So these are just reporting the cases, but here you can actually find out now the interpretations or the idea of the threshold modeling. So basically it might be the case that for some observations that are below zero, for the lagged observation of the actual series that we are interested in, the linear fit or the linear model between current observations and the AR1, so the one period lagged observations, changes. So it is negative before and positive after that. And here actually you can detect that even the constant term might clearly be different in the various regimes. So this is the same thing, but here we now assume that the constant terms are different. So constant term for the first period or first regime, not period, but regime, it's negative. And then for the second, it's positive. So basically here, the case where both are negative is it's still producing the same kind of behavior. And here where the first regime constant term is even positive and the second one is negative, it's still producing this difference. So these are the optimal, basically optimal fitted regression lines for the AR1 model when you fit this kind of setter representation to the data. So if you are skipping the possibility of this threshold behavior, then basically for this kind of set of observations, what kind of model would you be estimating? what kind of parameter estimate for the lagged values of one period, lagged values of y you would have when you try to explain with those the current observations. So skip basically this red line here. This is after we have fitted the setar model. But if you are generating, or you have an set of observations that is given by this kind of plot, scatter plot of observations, are you able to fit here any kind of linear representation? Try to fit here the best possible. What kind of representation in terms of a standard OLS linear regression representation between the one period lagged values and current observations you could fit here? Can you fit here anything? Basically, it would not be possible. Because if you fit a regression model where the coefficient of the lagged effects is about zero, so basically they do not have any kind of effect on the current observation. So it might be equally well to a case where you fit a model where the coefficient is actually quite close to one, or equally good where it is close to minus one. So basically it's perhaps not even possible to detect any kind of best linear unbiased parametric representation for the dependence here. What about in the second case? Is it possible to try?
Yes.
And what would be a linear representation look like? What is the sign of the coefficient on this yt minus one?
It would be positive.
Yeah, probably it would be positive, the best possible fit for a regression line here would probably be something that has a positive. You don't know exactly here, but basically, so it is actually possible that also a linear representation might be possible to fit here, but a nonlinear representation in the form of a setar model, which allows you to take into account that in the first regime, the constant term is negative, and in the second regime, the constant term is positive, and it's different in absolute value also, it might actually give you a better fit. So when you estimate the best possible representation for the first regime, it has a negative slope, and when you estimate the best possible representation for the second regime, it has a positive slope. So basically, this is very much dictated by the parameter estimates that you estimate to your model based on standard optimization rules. Here it's once again a bit different, perhaps. It's not so clear than here. Here you can have perhaps linear representation. Here it's not so, it's almost equally impossible to construct a unique representation between this observation as it is here. Here, perhaps in the last case, well, it might be possible to fit some kind of, but it's not so clear. And the main reason is that these are not, actually these observations are not possible to give in a linear dependence. So the past values of one period lagged observations are not having a, let's say, constant effect or a deterministic effect on the current observations. It depends on the value. Where is the lag? Where is the lagged value? Is it in the negative side or is it in the positive side? And that is actually the key thing here. This should give you an idea about the relevance. If we are just using a linear AR model, we are not able to detect this kind of time-varying relationship between the past observations and current observations. And this is actually very relevant. For example, modeling of the term structure of interest rates in the Euribor interest rate data, it is really relevant to take care of the role of the negativity of the interest rates, because they are clearly different. I would very much someone of you to take a closer look at the behavior of the term structure models or holding of the expectation hypothesis of the term structure during the negative interest rate era, because it is clearly different compared to the positive. So here we have these various or these four cases. In case one, the means of these two regimes are equal to zero, implying that there's a unique and stable equilibrium. The unconditional mean of the series is not equal to zero. Always after a negative return, the system jumps back to the positive regime where it has a tendency to stay and without shocks converts towards zero. In case two, so this is the case two here, there are two equilibria, minus 0.2 and plus 0.2, which are both stable. So in intuitive terms, without shocks, there's no tendency to move from one regime to the other. In the third case, there is a unique stable equilibrium equal to minus 0.2, and it's equilibrium of both of these regimes, so the mean of the absolute regime. And without shocks, the system moves always from the positive regime to the negative regime. There's no equilibrium in the fourth case at all. And even without shocks, the system converts to a limit cycle. So it has an endogenous dynamics even without the shocks. And if you are using linear representation, you are not able to detect this regime-dependent behavior in the dynamics of the data series that you are considering. Okay, so this model was called the first-order Setar model. Why is it first-order? First-order comes from the simple fact that we only had one lac of the y variable in the AR representation of the data. So instead of just one, we can have several lacs, and it can be the case that the number of lacs is actually not necessarily the same in both regimes. So these are very difficult to estimate, these models, when you have different lacs in the different regimes, but it is possible to do that. So one of the main question is to decide the correct lac length for the indicator variable, and we will be discussing that later. And this is actually one of the key references, this Teräsvirta and Anderson paper in Journal of Econometrics, that where they suggested a method that it's called a deterministic simulation. You don't have to pay too much attention to that. It's a kind of a time-consuming simulation exercise where you start from a set of assumed values for the observations and try to estimate the best possible lac structure for the both regimes. So you are trying various combinations of different and same lac structures in different regimes, and then basically try to estimate the smallest possible residual sum of squares for both these equations. So that is basically so that you would be getting to a situation where the expected value for this is zero. Don't pay too much attention to that. If you are interested about time series econometric theory, then go and have a look at that paper, but it's not necessary for applied purposes. It has been shown after that the right lac length of Setar model can be identified consistently by using information criteria. So basically, you can instruct the program to calculate the information criteria values, Akaike information and Bayesian Schwarzschild information criteria from the tried model that you are trying to fit to the data, and try to get once again to the lowest value for the information criteria. That would be giving you an idea about the best possible representation of the data. Timo Teräsvirta has actually, and Dick, actually this Dick, Hans Philips, Philip Francis have actually proved that it is valid to use these kind of Akaiken Bayesian and information criteria. It's based on calculation of these, using these information in the calculation of the. So basically, the information from the first and second residual variance is relevant, and then also the information from the used lacks in the first and second regime is relevant thing. Don't pay too much attention to that. The main message to you is that, like in the case of AR or ARMA models, you can use information criteria basically to make the choice of about the relevant lack structure in your model. So that is the main information here. What is relevant here is to take a look at the stationarity of the series always. So it's very difficult basically because this regime dependence actually introduces the possibility of stationarity originally to the model. So there are actually in many cases here in the original data, the stationarity condition gets to be violated actually. So there are this set of, for example, for an AR1 setar model with two regimes, there is a set of stationarity conditions regarding the estimated parameter estimates that should be met. After you have estimated the model, these are the conditions that should be met if you have a valid representation of the data. So take a look at these, whether they are met in the final results if you are fitting a two regime AR1 setar model to your data series. Do the final parameter estimates actually meet this? These actually can be generalized to M regime models. As an example of a M regime model might be the same nominal interest rate series from the euro area, because actually in terms of at least the variance of the data series, for example, 3-month interest rates, we actually observed a longer period of very low positive values for the observations with the before they dipped into the negative or dived more permanently there into the negative side of the observations. So it might be the case actually that a 3-regime model for the Euribor 3-month interest rate or Euribor 1-month interest rate actually, and also for Euribor 12-month interest rates might be relevant. So obviously you should test for the possibility that you actually have a 3-regime model. So for example, in this case, it would be the case that you have 3 regimes. So you would be testing for the possibility that you have 3 against 2. So it's just about estimation of the model once again. So basically it allows that the parameter estimates in the first regime are different from the parameter estimates in the second regime, and they are still different from the parameter estimate of the third regime. So there are 2 thresholds in this setter, 2 threshold values for the past observations if you're using a setter model. So you can try for that one also. And then things get even more complicated if you have more than 1 threshold variable. So in this case, now that we have been discussing a setter models, it might be the case that in, for example, term structure data, so when you have different maturity interest rates, it might be actually relevant to get also information, for example, from the overnight interest rate markets. When did the Eonia interest rate go negative before? It went negative before the Euribor 1 month, 3 months, and 12 months. Are the lagged values of Eonia relevant actually in terms of determining the regimes for the 1 month or 3 month Euribor rates. So in that case, you would have also something else than just the past information of the actual variable that you are interested about. So that is a generalization of these SETAR models. In SETAR case, you only have information about, let's say, for the 3 month interest rate, but there are two thresholds for that. If you have a three regime model, you have a two thresholds for that. If you have three thresholds, then you have four regime model for that. So basically you can increase the number of regimes based on the past history. But I would like to warn here that before going into these very complicated in terms of the lack structure of the threshold variables or threshold conditioning information, go back first to your idea about the economic relevance. Why would it be necessary to try to reveal that there are, for example, three or four regimes in the data generating process of, for example, interest rates or anything else? You should always bear in mind that you should try to get some kind of economic interpretation to the thresholds. Why is it relevant to try to detect many thresholds in the models? Usually, so do you hear me now?
Yeah.
And where did I lose you?
You were saying how they're getting very complicated and not to.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So it's getting very complicated when you want to use these more than two regime models. So it's, I suppose I was around here. So it is getting very complicated. I suppose it was this slide. So it is getting very complicated. So it seems that I have some problems with the connection here. So let's try once again. Are you now able to hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So the main thing here is that if you want to take a look at the more than, let's say, two regime models, three regime model, for example, in a SETAR case, which means that you have these Ys here, lagged Ys here, you are assuming that the actual series for, let's say, for example, Euribor 3 month interest rates, it's relevant in addition to extract the values at the negative side, also the values below one at the positive side and above zero. So when we were experiencing a, let's say, 3 years period of very low positive interest rates, is it relevant to extract that? Because that was actually the final stage of more or less conventional monetary policy situation. It might be relevant, but what might be the reason to include the possibility that you have four regimes? That would be really something that you would have to give an economic reasoning for that. Why should it be interesting to even try to model that kind of case? It seems to be that I'm still recording. I have some problems with the connection here at the moment, but let's try to still have some. Let's try to continue at as long as it holds. So these models are simply, they can be estimated by using maximum likelihood. Obviously, because they are nonlinear representations of the data, it's obvious that you only can use maximum likelihood estimation. Another method that is not so computationally time demanding, it's a bit more efficient, you can base that on the fact that if the threshold values would be known, the model could be estimated by applying piecewise kind of a linear regression on each of the regimes. So estimate linear regression for each of the regimes. So basically, you can, if you are able to somehow give an idea about the relevant threshold values, you can do obviously this estimation in a piecewise linear regression. So as an example of a two regime setter model with P1 and P2 lags, you basically just estimate the model where you have decided that, for example, Euribor interest rates, it's relevant to consider negative values differently from positive values. Then you are considering negative values. So Z is here once again, zero, and then positive values differently. And you are conditioning everything in the AR model based on the information about the negativity or positivity of the past observations, just one period past observations. So basically these P1 and P2 can be different here. That's the main message. But in this case, you should somehow be able to determine what is the relevant threshold. So it's always case dependent. How would you be interested? For example, in the currency market data, for example, for exchange rates, the appreciation of the currency would be relevant compared to depreciation. So there are two regimes also there. So usually in many cases, zero is kind of a relevant threshold value actually in setter models. So if the threshold value is known, then parameters can be estimated by OLS. That is obvious. So you can calculate those based on conditioning for the value of the threshold parameter there. So we have to require that the threshold values are such that each regime has enough observations. So this is the thing that I wanted to emphasize, that when you are using these models, go always first, once again, to take a look at the data. You have some idea whether it is relevant to extract these regimes, but even though you have this idea, you should also take care of the number of observations in the assumed different regimes. Do you have enough information in different regimes to be able to estimate the parameter estimates for the different regimes? So once again, take a good look at the data. There is actually a limit. Once again, Timo Teräsvirta has proved this, that there is actually a limit for this, that when you have at least 15% of the total number of observations in each regime, then it is actually possible to estimate also the parameter estimates. So first, take a good look at the data, calculate the mean values, for example, and if you want to specifically analyze the values above mean and below mean, or the values that are negative and positive, then calculate the number of those observations in both regimes. If there is more than 15% observations in each regime, then you are able to use basically the setter estimation procedure, for example. So obviously in the calculation or the using or the OLS-based minimization of the residual sum of squares, you need to give a starting value for the threshold variable also. And usually you start from the assumed value of the threshold. And the parameter estimates of the autoregressive terms are the ones that are associated with the optimal threshold value. So even though you start with the assumed that you are interested about it, it's not necessarily the case that you will end up in that at the final stage. If something else is more relevant in terms of optimizing the values for the parameter estimates in the model. So least squares is actually something that is consistent also to be used in these cases. And these guys, Hansen and Teräsvirta and Anderson, and these have actually proved this, that you can actually also use these likelihood ratio based test statistics to test for the relevance of the estimated threshold values in the model. So after you have estimated the model, you are able to calculate the variance of the error terms on a condition that the estimated value for the residual is the threshold value is holding there. And you start from this original assumption, for example, zero, and then at the optimal value, you evaluate also the residual behavior in terms of the variance and divide that by the optimal value. You are able to construct this likelihood ratio test. So this is the starting value. And it is proved that you can use these likelihood ratio based statistics there in the estimation of these models. Let's skip these parts where we are constructing these various test statistics, because they are basically not so necessary to take a look, but the actual steps when you want to estimate these SETAR models are the ones that you should somehow to understand or remember us here. So Clive Granger from the Engler-Granger pair has actually proposed this kind of specification procedure in general to any kind of regime-dependent models. And this holds also, for example, for the SETAR models. Specify first carefully a linear model. Try to find a best possible AR representation for the data. At the second step, test this linear model against the alternative non-linear or regime-dependent, any kind of model. It can be SETAR model, STAR model, or TAR model, or any of these models that we are discussing here. If the above null hypothesis is rejected for the linearity, or the non-linearity against the linearity is rejected, so that the linear representation is not the right one, so you are accepting the alternative hypothesis of nonlinear representation, then estimate the nonlinear regime dependent model. Try to find the best possible representation for the nonlinear representation, for example, SETAR model. Evaluate the model in terms of the goodness of fit statistics. How do the residuals behavior in different regimes, for example? Modify the model if the results are not good. So include, for example, more lax to the actual AR representation. But nevertheless, the first thing here is to test, or the major thing here is to test always against the possibility, test the linear model against the possibility of nonlinear model. If the linearity assumption is accepted, then there's no meaning even try to do these more difficult models for nonlinear representation, or it's not necessary to go those at all. So this is always the thing that you will be trying this, and you will be testing this for in the demonstrations. You get an idea about how to use the likelihood ratio tests for that. So here we have now discussed only the SETAR model, and tomorrow actually we will continue from these other models. So, and we will be starting from this practical example of SETAR models then, and then we will be moving towards the other models. So basically, you can, after you have estimated the SETAR model, one of the residual statistics test is to test for the normality, even though the normality of the residuals is not an absolute condition for the holding of the nonlinear models, but you can still test for that. This is relevant actually in terms of comparing between various nonlinear representations, whether SETAR model is valid or whether threshold autoregressive TAR model is valid or something else, which gives you normally behaving or normally distributed residuals. Okay, so let's take a look at these rest of the slides, and then we will go through tomorrow. We will start from the discussion of this SETAR model for an old data before euro area. It's for the French franc quotation against the German mark, because it gives a nice example of a data that is interesting to be analyzed, because basically this resembles the behavior of, for example, S&P 500 returns or anything like that. But basically it's possible now to detect various regimes in these price series, or this quotation for the French franc against the German mark. So take a look at these slides tomorrow before we go into the discussion of the results, and try to take a look at these results in view of answering me some questions about the relevance of these model, whether it is relevant or not. We will be discussing these results in more details tomorrow. We have not basically discussed those here in the slides, so we will start from the discussion of these models, whether it is relevant to use a SETAR model or not. You should be able to answer me tomorrow. We will start from that. So we will first go with this and then start from the discussion. I hope that the recording was not interrupted, even though I had these problems here. But okay, let's continue tomorrow from this example at 9:15.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.